Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 585 for Monday, the 19th of November, 2018. My name is Derek Cabrera and joining me today is Jim McDowell. Jim, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. Going to cover that final race from Valencia. So it was an interesting weekend there. It was kind of like rainy and chilly, and it's kind of like here, it's rainy and chilly.
Yeah, it was seemed to be an interesting weekend in Spain. Definitely like weather we're having here over on the East Coast, and I don't know how it's been in the Midwest over there, but yeah, it's almost Thanksgiving.
Yes, almost U.S. Thanksgiving, which means sadly that racing has come to an end.
Yes, unfortunately. But yeah, so we're going to be covering the race from Valencia this week. First of all, we would like to say thank you to everyone who has left a donation. You can find us at motopodcast.com. You can donate there. We have a Patreon page. Any little bit helps. So thank you so much for everyone who's donated and everyone to donate. Yeah, like we say every week, it really helps us out just with expenses for being able to get to these races every now and then, do some interviews, and keep us going through the winter here while we still bring you some really good content. So thank you, everyone. And yeah, other than that, we're basically going to just jump into the very limited amount of news that we have. But we do have a couple notes. The biggest one being, which was announced earlier today, that Moto 3 and Moto 2 are going to now have the MotoGP Superpole Superbike qualifying format, which is thank the Lord, because I definitely feel like that's going to add a lot of depth to those qualifying formats, and also hopefully help prevent a lot of the issues they've been having in especially Moto 3.
Yeah, I think this is a good move. It was going to have to happen just for continuity's sake alone. The fact that, you know, you guys in Moto 2 and Moto 3 are running around for 45 minutes and people are online, offline, looking for tows, etc. You know, kind of really they've done everything they could to sort of prevent that and keep that from happening, but it hasn't really worked. So now you have continuity. You're going to be used to this. You got to go out there, take your fastest 14 people from your practice sessions. You got to be on it. You got to be at the top of your game. Then you get to go directly to the Q2. Everybody else, you're battling for, I think, four places. They're going to take the top four from the Q2 session, and they're going to put you into that Q1. So you're going to have 18 people run for pole, which I think is a great way to do it. That's usually where the fast guys are anyway. They're always in that top bit. And it should throw up a couple of surprises here and there, which we've seen happen in MotoGP, where we don't expect somebody to be in Q1, and they wind up going through to Q2 and even on to pole, like we've seen Marquez do. So it was something that needed to be done. I'm glad that it's changed, and I like the idea. I've loved this format that they use now for MotoGP because, like I said, it's fast-paced. Things are happening, and it's generally exciting. There's no waiting around in the lull because everybody has to be on it from the very beginning.
Yeah, I think Moto 3 is going to be, in my head, I feel like it's going to be less exciting. I think they're still going to have issues with riders in the tow, especially for FP1 and FP2, because it's going to be so important. Probably FP3 is probably going to be the biggest one, right? Because they'll still have time to get in, but so we'll see exactly how Race Direction handles that. But in general, for, you know, starting the grid and finding out who's going to be where, Moto 3 will still be interesting, but qualifying's never held like a whole lot of importance in Moto 3, because as long as you're on the first like 3 to 4 rows, you're still going to be in the front. But for Moto 2, I think it's really going to be a game changer. And yeah, I'm just so excited for Moto 2 next year in general. But we're going to talk about that a little bit later this winter. A lot of changes happening. We're focusing on the now. and some more now news is really the only other thing that came up on our radar was there's a fantastic commentary by Peter Hickman's Fastest Lap Around the Isle of Man, which I have yet to see. But Jim, you've watched it, right?
Yeah, I did. It is an amazing onboard lap. Hickman describes the lap in detail and the whole way around. It's only like 16 and a half minutes to cover the 37 and three quarter miles, which he's just absolutely moving. It's shocking because within the first 6 minutes, I wet myself twice. By the time we got to 10 minutes, I needed a new pair of underwear. He is literally at the limit of what I think you could do. And what makes it even scarier is he is held up by a back marker that he's trying to lap, and he loses maybe a good second and a half to maybe 2 seconds. So that lap he was on could have been even faster than what it was. So budget some time. You can find it. It's in my Twitter feed. I did a retweet of it. So it's at MotoRGV. Or I think if you go to the official Isle of Man video page or just Google it, you'll find it. And you definitely, as a motorcycle fan, if you're a fan of the island, if you're a fan of roads racing, you need to sit down and you need to watch it, preferably on some big, large TV screen, if at all possible, because you can't really get the idea of what's going on if you're looking at it on your little small phone screen. But it is an impressive lap around the island.
And that's pretty cool, too, because generally they like make you pay to like for those onboard laps for like a full lap. They have them on iTunes and stuff. And I'm sure like you can find them on YouTube, but like for the Isle of Man like official page to make that available to everyone, I think is super cool. But also talking about Peter Hickman, something we didn't have in the news is the Macau Grand Prix was this past weekend, and I believe Peter Hickman won, didn't he?
I don't, the only thing I saw from Macau or have had time to see with work commitments and whatnot was the very scary crash for the FP, for the Formula 3 cars that basically went almost into an apartment building. Mm. That was pretty crazy, but I did not see any motorcycle coverage yet.
Yeah, I haven't been able to watch any coverage. Here in the States, it's really difficult to get any of the Macau stuff, and if you get it, it's, you know, like 3 months later on a 30-minute highlight reel, so... it's pretty frustrating for us. I did see there was a live stream, but it would end up being 3 o'clock here on the East Coast, so I didn't get to watch the live stream. But yeah, from what I understand, Peter Hickman won. Maybe we'll have some more coverage about Macau in a little later episode. Maybe Dave and Andy can walk us through that a little bit more. Not something that was on our news docket, but I thought I'd throw it in there anyway. Big congratulations to Peter Hickman. I think he was battling Michael Rutter on the RCV MotoGP replica bike, which was gorgeous livery in like black and gold. But yeah, like I said, we'll probably get to that in a later episode. But for now, we have some Valencia Grand Prix to talk about.
Mm-hmm. So we'll start off with some Moto3 qualifying, just quickly go through it. It was a wet quali, but it was drying, and it was wild because everybody was falling. As soon as you looked around, somebody had fallen. I mean, Bezzecchi had a great lap. He went to the top. He fell. Ramirez fell. Migno fell. But what really came out of the qualifying session was this Turkish rider, a young 15-year-old named Cho Onçu, and he's been mentored by Kenan Sofoglu, another Turkish great. But he was riding around in the rain. He was at the top. He would set a fast lap. Some other people would come by. They would put a faster lap in. But he kind of kept his head down, kept trying, and really did not seem to be fazed by the conditions whatsoever. He did have a low side, but he was able to get back up, continue on. But as it came down, the track was getting drier and drier, and the question came up, was anybody going to gamble and go out on slicks? And someone did, and that person was Alberto Areno. And he went, or not, sorry, not Areno, it was Arbolino. He went out on slicks. He actually set the fastest time and was able to take pole. He was then followed by Aruta Puvapat. I have a very tough time with that name.
Nacarin Atarat Puvapat. That's what it is.
There you go. And then McPhee, and then Onçu was fourth. Now, for a 15-year-old to come in to a highly contested class like this and pull off a fourth in a dry track would have been something special. To have done it in a wet conditioned race was even better. So Anshu was keeping his head. He was riding within himself, and it was very impressive considering the number of people who actually went down, and even the fact that people who we think of as the predominant pretenders to the class, like Martin, he was 13th, Bastianini was 14th, DiGiantonio 15th. I mean, those are some really big names. And you know, he even out-qualified Bezzecchi, who was 5th. So this kid appears to have all the tools to be a contender in the class.
Yeah, and I think one thing to note too, like, you know, I think 2 years ago he was in the Asia Talent Cup, and you know, when you end up doing those races, you know, you have a couple races in Sepang, and you know, you need to know how to ride in the wet. So to be able to win that championship, you know, the kid obviously knows how to ride in the wet, as does his brother Dennis, which, you know, once they were in that championship, they were making a lot of noise. And then this year in the Red Bull Rookies, which I covered fairly decently, I watched most of the races. Both of them were right at the top of the field, but and I think they also did CEV this year too, and with the IO team. So he wasn't new to IO this year per se, but to actually see him be so quick and so competitive on a Moto3 grid in the World Championship, like, you never know if how that step is going to be. But obviously for Chan, and you know, it's kind of a shame we're not seeing Dennis at the same time too, but I don't know what the politics about that are, but obviously Chan is incredibly quick and deserves that ride. You know, fourth in qualifying, and you know, really the talk of the weekend.
He was. The thing that I was trying to figure out, again, you might be right on the nail on the head with his brother and politics, was they were talking about that he's his twin brother, which should make them the same age, but they're saying how his brother wasn't going to be able to get to the class until 2020.
Yeah, I think it's because, one, Chan has won the Red Bull Rookies Cup, so I think they made like a special dispensation for him to race.
Gotcha.
And also, okay, gotcha. Dennis, even though they are the same age, they are at different points of puberty. Chan is slightly larger, and obviously you want to be small on a Moto3 bike, but Dennis is a tiny kid.
Okay.
And so I think another year of like actual maturation, he'll be like physically ready to be on that bike full time. I don't know if that's the main reason, but like if you just look at him side by side, like Dennis looks like he's 12, if that, maybe 8. I don't know. Kids just look young now.
Well, this segment of biology class brought to you by Derek Cabrera. Professor Cabrera.
So, no more questions, right, please. Well, class is dismissed. Anyway, back to the racing.
Yes, so the race takes off from Moto3. And it had been predicted that it was going to be a rainy day, and it was. It was a light rain that was coming down, so the race is declared wet. So that took a lot. That may have played into some people's hands, just because there was now no choice of tires. It's a wet tire. Dunlap only brings like one compound of wet tire for Moto3. And basically, when the lights went out, it was at the beginning, I would say, a small crash fest. Because we had, you had Arbolino, who took off and was out front. And he was looking pretty good from there. You had all the other guys were trying to keep up. But Bezzecchi was down at turn 4. He was down, came back up. Martin, who had qualified in 13th, was sort of running a very smooth and very calculated race, I would say. He kind of was slowly working his way back through the grid. John McPhee, who had a very good race as well, he was working his way through in a very calm, smooth ride as well. But there was so much chaos that was going on, and everybody was kind of paying attention, a lot of attention to Anshu, which deservedly so. The kid is definitely quick, but what we saw in him was he was there basically in 4th. He had a moment that came out of the seat. He then settled himself back in, which showed a great level of maturity, and he put his head down again, and he set out with it. And he thought, okay, well, you know, this is where it's basically going to be. He's you know, he might get onto the podium, and that would have been a great result as a wild card for sure. But, you know, things worked in his favor. Arbolino was leading and wound up falling down, and he was maybe gifted the race win a little bit, but you got to give the kid credit. He kept his head. Even on the next to last lap, he still almost went out. He went out of the seat and still almost lost it again at the end. But Anshu, by winning and being, I think, 15 years old and only like 151 days or something like that, becomes the youngest ever MotoGP winner. And that was pretty amazing unto itself. He beat Scott Redding's record.
Yeah, I thought that was a pretty poetic thing that happened, you know, like on Scott's last day, he, you know, his record was taken from him. You know, it's kind of like a sign, I feel like, that, you know, like, all right, this chapter of your life has closed, you know? That's just one deep observation that I've taken away from this weekend. But yeah, man, you know, Chan was just, he rode a fantastic race. And, you know, obviously a kid like that wants to win, but to be at the front all race long. And like you said, he was kind of gifted. But at the same time, like, you got to stay on the bike to win. So even though Arbolino had that lead, you know, maybe he was pushing it too much and the tire was gone, or, you know, whatever. I mean, it really was a race of attrition, and you just had to stay on the bike was half the battle. There was like a quote that the commentators kept saying all weekend long from Alvaro Bautista, like, it's just going to be like, who stays on the bike. And that was true for all three classes, really.
Oh, yeah. There was even talk that they were saying that as the track, in a light rain, the track was actually slicker than if there was more water on the track, which is a little weird. But, you know, maybe that's exactly part of the reason a lot of these guys were down. I mean, you know, we had the leaders fall down. We had, I think, Bezzecchi had two falls on there. It was a wild race where you didn't know what was going to happen, and it's, you have to make sure that you're maintaining your concentration. And in races like that, in those kind of conditions, you have to stop racing the other competitors. You have to just worry about yourself and focus on what you're doing and put in your smooth laps, and whatever's going to happen is going to happen. And you have to kind of size it up that way. And it took an amazing amount of concentration to stay on in that race. You could see it from all the guys, and, you know, any of the onboard shots, the guys that had the clear visors, their focus, their unblinking, their concentration is like 10 times harder. And I know when I ran club races, when I run a couple races in the rain, I was more mentally exhausted than I was physically exhausted, just because it's so intense having to focus for that long of a time. And, It was a great race to watch. It was an interesting race to watch. And, you know, by, you know, Martin coming in second and then his teammate DG Antonio coming in fourth, they were able to lock down Gresini's team's championship. They are also able to give Honda the constructors championship for the Moto3 class. So that was it. And you know, one more thing about Anshu, he becomes the first person to win on his debut since Ueda did it in 1991 at the Japanese Grand Prix, riding in, of course, the 125 class at that time. So it was an interesting, crazy race that led us to witness a bit of history. And who knows, this kid might be the kid to challenge Marquez. He might be that talent, but that's putting a lot on his shoulders. But he showed us a lot, I thought.
Yeah, super impressive ride. I think one of the rides of the day. You know, kind of taking a look at the finishers list. I think Jorge Martin did a fantastic race. He was ready to get on with next year once he won the championship. This was like a big release from him. So you didn't see him charging at the front right from the get go, but, you know, he rode an incredibly intelligent race and walked away with second place because of it, which I thought was huge. It's great to see John McPhee back on the podium. DiGiantonio got that second place in the championship. One name that really stood out to me, though, was Drama Masia. He had a huge crash. Was it in Sepang or was it in Phillip Island? He got taken out, right? And he was in the hospital for a while and just looked pretty severe. So to see him at finishing sixth, I don't think the race commentators said anything about him. At least not that stuck in my mind. But to see that on paper, that's super impressive to me. But yeah, I think probably one of the most underrated rides of the day was from Jorge Martin, just being so calculated and not aggressive and still getting 20 points from that. Not that it particularly mattered, but I think that shows a lot of maturity.
I agree. It's going to be interesting next year because a lot of the guys that we see at the top, Martin, Bezzecchi, they all have Moto2 rides. So again, the Moto3 class is going to be up for grabs, and looks like the man who might reach out and grab it and hang on to it might be Anshu. Who knows? But
could be Fanati. Who knows?
Could be.
Who knows?
Could be. Yes. Who knows? So that wraps up the Moto3. So we will move to Moto2 qualifying. Now, by Moto2 qualifying, it had dried out to the point where people were on slicks for that one. And it was typical classic Moto2 qualifying. Within the first 15 minutes, Luca Marini had thrown down a very fast lap and looked really good while he was doing it. And you kind of wait to see if anybody could actually knock him back off. And everybody took a shot at it, but nobody could. And it wound up with Marini, followed by Xavi Verhe. Marcel Schroeder of Benyaya was fourth. Baldassare fifth, Lowe's was sixth, Juan Mir was seventh, and then Augusto Fernandez eighth, ninth Quartararo, and tenth was Miguel Oliveira. His teammate Binder was behind him, and that's kind of where everybody was. Shout out to Joel Roberts being 19th, and then Lecuona was actually 21st, but it was definitely the normal Moto2 qualifying scenario that we've seen all year long.
Yeah, that's about it. Typical Moto2 qualifying. I'm glad we're getting rid of that because, you know, just a quick 10 minutes of, you know, watching them go out and then that's that. I'm kind of done with. But who knows? The Triumphs coming in could be a totally different thing, but we'll never know. We just get to enjoy the nice Super Pole format, and I'm super excited about that. So, you know, I'm not going to even say it's a bittersweet last CBR 600 Moto2 qualifying because it's not bittersweet whatsoever. Glad it's done with.
You know, the biggest thing I'm looking forward to is going to be the sound the Triumph makes. It's definitely different. And it's very, very different. And I think that's going to be one of the cool things about it is it's going to be new. Everybody's sort of back to ground zero again. And I'm looking forward to it as well. So, onto the very final CBR 600 based Moto2 race. Again, it's been raining. It's still raining. It's a light rain. And as the guys get off the line and they head to turn two, you had Marini, Mir, Baldassare all wind up going down at that second turn. Bagnaia was actually touched by his teammate and he somehow magically kept it upright. But he was now way back into like 23rd. And it was pretty much a crazy second corner. Mir appeared to fall on his own after Marini had locked the front end up. Apparently, it was one of those deals where, at least to me, it seemed like the track was wet, but there wasn't enough rain to actually make the brakes non-functional too. So a lot of guys, to me, looked like they were overpowering the grip that was available to them on the front tire because they had more brake than what there was traction available, or at least in that first instance. So basically Verhe, Oliveira, Pessini, Binder, and Marquez and Lecuona were now out front. Oliveira had kind of assumed his position out front, which was kind of nice to see him actually out there. But Marquez was chasing him for a little bit, and Marquez was throwing in some pretty good laps. And you remember the last time, I think, that Marquez had actually won a Moto2 race was in Japan in the rain. So big things were possibly on the cards for him. But then we had Binder had crashed, and then Marquez, again, with his head down, was catching Oliveira, and he was definitely making a run for the front. Quartararo, and we didn't mention that at the beginning, but Quartararo's bike did not fire up on the grid. He could not get away in time for the siding lap. And I'm wondering if it was like a slipper clutch problem, because they tried to run it on the starter, on the wheel spinner, but it wouldn't start. They tried to bump start it, and then that still wouldn't get it. But they were able to get it once it went into the pit lane. So Quartararo actually had started dead last in the race and had worked his way up to ninth, which is really a pretty good ride from Quartararo. Again, maybe proving why he's actually got a MotoGP ride. But as soon as that had happened, Marquez wound up crashing, and he went down. It was an interesting crash because I think it was in the very last turn. I think it was at the turn 14, I believe. But they had a nice onboard of it, and you could hear Marquez on the throttle, close the throttle off, and then he could then take it, and was gliding into the corner. And you know the revs is bottomed out, and he just cracked the throttle open. You could actually hear it, and then wham, the back end went away from him, and down he went. Then Joel Roberts had got himself up to seventh, and the commentator curse affected him, as then he was he fell off at turn two, and he knew he had a good chance at some really decent points. His reaction when he got up from the gravel trap was that heartbreak of hands on helmet that you see from so many guys.
And I think the frustrating thing for Joe too is like he got punted off at the first corner with the big collision between the Riders and Mir and everything. He was dead last, and he was up to seventh or sixth at that point when he went down. So I do have to say, like, my first viewing of this race, as soon as I saw Joe went down, I turned it off. I was so mad too, because because Joe has been waiting for a wet race all year. He's made no secrets about him knowing he can perform better in the wet than a lot of his competitors. So to see that opportunity kind of be wasted, I was frustrated, you know, because like I knew this was his chance, and he knew it was his chance, just as a fan, as a spectator. And I finished the race. I finished watching it, but
you're a dedicated individual to Motopod.
But yeah, man, that was like, you could see the frustration. Like, you rarely see Joe like that. You know, he's a cool Californian kid, and he was upset.
Mm-hmm. That was sad to see. He has a ride where he gets a Kalex next year, right? Or
I'm not sure.
I thought he did.
What team he's going on, the Swiss Intervention Sam?
Yeah, he's going. Yeah, he gets. Right? He gets the KTM. He gets the KTM chassis.
Well, I don't know if they're sticking with KTM. I don't think it's been announced.
Well, something we'll figure out in testing.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, in all honesty, I hope he gets a Kalex, just because it's not a known quantity. Everything's an unknown quantity next year, I guess. But like, you know, Kalex and Olin's, at least, you know, that's what the majority of the field is going to be on. So at least he can have a measuring stick, you know, and not be on a totally new bike with a new manufacturer. And I have to say, like, with all that being said, like, I think he's done a really good job this year. Obviously done well enough to get a ride on a pretty good team. Luigi was on that team for a good long time, so you know the people around it can create a competitive package. Maybe not this year with the KTM. Maybe they're going to try to stick with KTM. We'll see. Again, testing show. Stay tuned for that. Anyway, moving forward on the race, rain kept coming down, and it's like the Moto3 race, it was just stay on the bike, you know.
Yep. Vierge was down from third. There was all these crashes, and then you had to some extent Oliveira was basically gone. Lecuona had now come to second, and you know, Lecuona is only 18.
I think that's crazy. Like, I have to remind myself that, like, a bunch, because he has done things an 18-year-old would do, you know, just keep crashing out of really, really good positions. But the fact that he is 18 and gets to those positions on a bike that Sam Lowes has struggled on immensely this year, you know, Lecuona has really made that look competitive. And to remember, he's only 18.
Yeah.
Is like what's going to be to come of him is, I don't know, is he going to be Joe's teammate next year on that bike? Is he staying on that team?
I thought he was, but I could be wrong.
I'm not sure. We're not 100% on that one. We'll double check that. But still, like that would be a great talent again to push Joe and push push that team, because I think he's been phenomenal this year, and for him to kind of hold on to that second place in terrible conditions where he could have easily thrown it down the road was again another super impressive ride.
So as all this crazy is going on, Marquez, who falls off at the last turn, gets back on, and the front three were so far out front that he went from basically second to third, which goes to show you sort of the disparity that was in that race. It was people were all over the track in all different places and whatnot, but Marquez picks the bike back up to run third. Quartararo, by this point, had worked his way back to fifth, which was an absolutely storming race for Quartararo. He was actually passed, though, towards the end by Remy Gardner, and Remy finished fifth on the Mistral Tech 3 bike in its last race that it's ever going to be ran in, because we know that Tech 3 is going to use the KTM chassis next year. But Remy putting on his best result that he's had in Moto2 and looked really good, and it kind of showing that Australian dirt tracker that's inside of him. So the race finished off with Oliveira winning. It was about time Oliveira actually won something in this class, and it's been quite a while. I think he won at maybe Mugello or something early on in the year, but that was the last time. It had been quite a while. So Lecuona got his first ever podium there in second. Marquez, again, after having fallen off, finished third and on the podium. The sad part to me is that Pessini finishes fourth in this race, does not have a ride for next year as of right now, yet Fanati does. And I think there's some sort of cruel injustice about that, and that's as much as I would like to say about that part of it. Then Gardner is fifth, Quattro, as we said, sixth, Schroeder, Fernandez, Locatelli, and then rounding out the top 10 was Corsi. So again, it was another very interesting race. You had a lot of chaos involved in there, and you had some great rides from people coming through the back of the pack, which rain is the great equalizer, as they say, Derek, and it doesn't really matter what bike you have. It depends on how talented you are and how much fuel you have and how much connection you can make between your right wrist and the rear tire that's on that bike and find your way around in the circumstances. And it's kind of interesting, you know, the guys that you think of as, you know, kind of dirt track background kind of guys, Gardner, Alex Marquez, they were able to see and sense the changing track conditions and were able to ride in or near the limit each and every lap to keep themselves near the front, which left it be a fascinating final inline four-cylinder 600 CBR class race.
For sure, yeah. It was a good race. I wouldn't say does this make sense? It's a good race, but the racing wasn't good. Does that make sense?
Yeah, there wasn't really a lot of competition in the race, yeah. I'll give you that. But it was interesting because there was so many different things that were happening. You had people coming through the pack, and yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what makes it interesting. And that's why I end up really liking wet races. It's not so much, you know, rarely do you have like a really good wet race. You know, actually in MotoGP, like you end up having really good wet races because like the competition's so close, and I think the gap is so much smaller in MotoGP, and, you know, being able to, like you said, you know, equalizes everyone, you know, it makes it a little bit more interesting. But, just the storylines from this race were interesting, but the actual racing was not.
Yeah. I think it's all going to be different next year. I don't think you're going to see these runaway races. I think it's definitely going to be tightened up, but we'll see in testing.
We're really selling this testing show. Just everyone, yeah. keep listening.
So let's go to the final race of the day, the MotoGP race. And we'll go back to qualifying on Saturday. Now, the MotoGP qualifying happens after the Moto3 qualifying. So the guys in the MotoGP were out on a track that had a predominantly dry line, but anywhere off that line was definitely wet. It was interesting. There were some very big names and big hitters that are in that Q1. Rossi was there along with his teammate Vinales, Iannone, and Lorenzo. They were all in QP1. And it came down on that first session, a straight fight between Vinales and Iannone to see who was going to obtain pole in that particular session, and you know, get one of the two coveted spots to get yourself into Q2. Eventually, Iannone did take the first position, followed by Vinales. Those two were going to go on to it. Jorge Lorenzo actually had, like, I don't know if I'd call it a soul-searching moment, but he had a moment in the pits where he kind of like got himself straightened out. And as Simon Crafar said, he actually was doing his usual pre-race ritual, which he hadn't been doing previously. And again, he was playing hurt, but he definitely wanted to ride. So I think Lorenzo still has a bit of doubt about riding in the rain or racing in the rain. And so for him to kind of come in there and at least go to the third spot in that first qualifying session was a pretty heroic ride by Lorenzo. The interesting thing was that Rossi couldn't make anything happen at all with that Yamaha, and he was definitely not going anywhere.
Yeah, I honestly didn't even watch Q1 this go around. I woke up a little late and only actually caught QP2, so yeah, I think that's pretty much it for Q1.
Oh, so we get to talk about the superhuman effort of a certain individual in QP2 then.
Yes, you saw that. Exactly. I did see that, which let's get right to it because it happened in the first couple minutes. Mark goes down. Was it turn one that he went down? No, it was turn four.
Turn four, the first of the right-handed turns.
Yeah, yeah. So he goes down and his shoulder just pops out. As Scott Redding has made his shoulder so weak, obviously he's had problems with that, and I think Jim, me and you have talked about that before. The shoulder problem and how like it could be career ending really if it's not done right. But the shoulder popped out, and it was not good news. But you know, as Mark Marquez does, this, you know, shoulder dislocation, not a big deal. He got back to the pits, got the shoulder popped back in, had a couple deep breaths in his box, and then went out to actually set some lap times with, I think, like 7 minutes to go. So it wasn't even, it didn't even take him that long to get back to that point, which, again, it, you know, only Marquez, you know.
Yeah, he got off that bike, it was in the gravel trap, and he stood up and his left arm was immediately limp. He couldn't really do anything with it, and you could see the pain in his eyes. I have never personally dislocated a shoulder. However, I have a friend who did dislocate a shoulder at the racetrack, and he was in some excruciating pain while that shoulder was out. And, you know, they did their best to try to pop it back in. But for Marquez to get on a pit bike, be ridden back to his garage, go into the trailer and have his team put his arm back in place and put his shoulder back in its socket is amazing. Let alone to say, okay, I'm now going to go back and get on a 250 or 280 horsepower motorcycle on a damp but drying track and go qualify again is beyond anything that I think I've really ever witnessed in racing history. I've seen some guys ride with, you know, Lorenzo rode with two broken ankles in China when he was a rookie.
I don't know. I think the Lorenzo collarbone thing and ass, and like that's still top of my pile.
Yep, that's still amazing as well. But Marquez's popped shoulder and go ride again is definitely there on it, because it looked as though he was even really trying to push pretty hard.
Well, he's done this before too. Like he popped it out in Silverstone, like in 2014, 2015. He popped it out in like the morning warm up, and he came in second. He had like a serious fight with Lorenzo during that race, right? So yeah. Like he's obviously showed us he could do this before. And was I wonder? I mean, I've never popped out a shoulder either, but I wonder because it has popped in and out a couple times. Like he obviously knows the pain and knows, you know, where. He knows what's going on, so that necessary fear of like what's happening, like what's going on isn't there. And I think him experiencing that and knowing what's going on probably allows him to get through that and hop on the bike literally within minutes, as opposed to just needing to sit out the rest of the session.
Yeah, you probably hit the nail on the head on that one. Is you now know what it's like, and so therefore you don't have that worry of, oh, what just happened to me, which is just a natural human instinct. But what I also like to look at with Marquez is he can compartmentalize things so well. His mental state, his strength of his, I don't want to say thought process, but his mental strength, his ability to do this kind of stuff is absolutely amazing. That's the part that I find absolutely intriguing, because next year, you know, Lorenzo is going to try to pull all kinds of mind games and tricks. And, you know, Rossi was always the master of getting inside of somebody's head. And I just don't think these guys have any chance at all to get inside of Mark's head. His mental fortitude is just enormous. And if you didn't think that or didn't believe that, now you sure better, because that's one thing to pop out your shoulder and then pop it back in, but still I still find it, you know, in the top five amazing things that Jim has seen at a racetrack. Lorenzo's collarbone probably still is number one though. But after that, we had Petrucci, we had Rins, we had Dovi, we had Miller, Iannone and Zarco. They were all at the front or very near. They were all turning very fast laps. Miller fell off, which is kind of becoming sort of the norm for him in qualifying, that is. We actually had Marquez go back to the top of the list with a few minutes left to go. Then Zarco fell off. But eventually it wound up with Maverick Viñales looking very well put on the Yamaha, followed by Rins, who basically looked super almost the entire weekend up to this point. He was definitely on pace and looking very, very good on the Suzuki. In fact, I would have tipped Rins for great things and for a potential win at this point, because, you know, Valencia is a small go-kart-ish type of track, and the Suzuki is probably the best handling motorcycle that exists on there. And having the relatively short straightaways, the top end speed was not going to be so much of a deficit to the Suzuki, because you could make it up on the brakes or make it up with the handling on there. But Dovizioso was a third, Petrucci was fourth, Marquez slid back to fifth, popped out shoulder and put back in again all by itself. But a big shout out to Paul Espargaro on the KTM, having gone directly into QP2 and then actually putting in a great lap to be sixth on the grid. Bravo, sir. And then Iannone, seventh. His brother on the Aprilia, in eighth, he also did not have to, was also able to go directly to Q1. I think it's the first time this year that Aprilia has been able to do that. So that is a great thing. Looks like Aprilia is gaining ground and trying to look better, as they've kind of got the right parts and pieces together.
Yeah, and we'll see too, because like, I think Alesh is using like some of the 17 stuff on that bike now. He like finally convinced them to use like the older stuff.
To my opinion, to my knowledge, it's a 17 frame with the 18 motor.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, that makes sense. But yeah, again, about the qualifying, to have six manufacturers in the top eight was amazing. You know, it's like, that's the dream for all the manufacturers to be competitive. And like you said, because Valencia's just a really tight, twisty track, it really bunches a lot of the manufacturers up. And especially for qualifying for a one lap, hot lap pace, it allows us to see that. And I think it's amazing.
Yeah, we might have to, my Spanish isn't very good. We might have to ask Lynn, but is Ricardo Tomo translate into like Titan Twisty or something. I thought,
isn't it named
no,
after...
it's actually, it's a name of a racer. Yeah, it's yeah. a name of a racer. But oh, yeah.
I didn't know how far off you were, Jim.
Generally, when it comes to translations and things like that, yeah, I'm completely nowhere near it. But that one, that one I actually know. So that was kind of how qualifying ended up for MotoGP. And then we got into the race. Of course, the race, it was definitely wet. And it took off from the beginning with Rins taking off, getting the whole shot. Of an interesting note, only one person varied from the soft rear Michelin rain tire, and that was Marquez. He was on a medium rain. Now, I don't know if that was a strategic thing or a feel thing for him, but I don't know if he thought maybe the track would dry out and so the medium would last longer, or just his riding style. He felt like he couldn't make a soft tire last in those conditions, but it was going to be interesting to see how that was going to play out. As again, as they started out, Rins was out front, and then Rins basically had another gear. He was in a class by himself there at the beginning. He was putting in fast laps after fast laps, and he was really looking very strong. And I thought he was on for the win. Like, I didn't think he could be caught at all at that point with the way that he was riding. Pol Espargaró was looking awesome on the KTM. He was really, really, really looking good. Rossi magically, you know, Mr. Sunday had moved his way up to seventh. Then you had Vinales going backwards for some reason. I guess that's just the norm with him nowadays.
Yeah, I think that's just like how he starts, you know? Like he just kind of goes backwards and then he goes forwards.
Obviously, Vinales does not have a wet setup for the Yamaha, but apparently Rossi does have a wet setup for that. So that unto itself is an interesting little side tidbit that's there. So again, I cannot say enough superlatives about Rins at this opening segment of the race, because he was just literally amazing. He was putting distance on everybody, and you have to admit that some of the fastest guys in the wet have been sort of Marquez, and he's been very fast in the wet. Rossi's always been a good wet rain rider. Dovizioso is a good rain rider, and Rins was really making them really look pretty ordinary. So he was definitely on a different plane. He was in the zone and was looking really good. At that point, we had Marquez winds up going down. And then you had Pol Espargaró went down. And it's sort of like, oh no, it's all happening again. You know, we got sort of gone into a repeat or a lookalike of the Moto 2 and the Moto 3 races with everybody falling off.
Yeah, they were hefty crashes too. Like Mark's crash was caught on camera, which was a big one. I think the rear just ended up letting go and he went down super hard, and it looked like the shoulder popped out again. But that was pretty big. And then in the post race interviews and stuff, Paul was saying that he had a huge crash, and they didn't really show the crash. They just showed him kind of getting up. So I tried to like find some videos of it. I couldn't find anything. And I actually ended up using the, you know, you know how on the video pass you can like figure out like what angle you want to watch from. I selected to watch from the helicopter, and you see his crash, and he literally just goes over the handlebars of the bike, and the bike is still going, and he's like on it, and he has to like bail off the bike in the gravel trap. He gets thrown off. It's like, it's pretty gnarly. But that's like the only camera angle I was able to find of like the full crash. But I don't know if we've touched on it already, but Maverick goes down, and Maverick has a massive crash. The thing was huge, and he was saying that was an electrical fault.
Really?
That he was like trying to ride around some electronic on the bike, but you know, he's been using that. I like Maverick, but I don't, because he's the king of excuses. You know, he just like there's always a reason why something's not working. So this one was that there was a electronic problem on the bike and he needed to ride around it, but at the same time I could totally see it being feasible because it went down in such a weird spot.
Yeah it was kind of an odd crash, that is true. So I don't know if you caught this in the Marquez replay, but I did. I thought it's just kind of an interesting little tidbit. you could, they, all the, and you probably know this better than anyone, Derek, but all the Dainese and Alpinstar suits, there's a little segment somewhere on a rider's arm. It's generally on their left. And it's a little set of lights that are sewn in there to show you the airbag and green, it's armed and ready to go. But Marquez's crash, you could see his left arm, he had the two yellow lights, meaning that the system had been deployed on it. And you can actually see it because I guess it was dark enough in the range you could see the two lights come on. So it's kind of interesting how to see that kind of technology and how that works in the suits and whatnot.
One that was really good for the suit and the airbag is Ludi's crash, because they have it on super slow-mo. And so probably around like halfway when he's in the air, he's fully off the bike, you can see the suit just deploy. And I think that one's really cool. You can probably find it on, they probably just have the clip of that one. But anyway, like if you're interested in that airbag technology stuff, that find that one and just watch that replay, because that's, you see how everything works, and it's pretty cool. But again, the airbag systems, and now that everyone has to use them, and they have the gorgeous super slow-mos, like you get to see every little bit of it, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, there's some insane tech in there as far as the math and the algorithms that are there to decide when to deploy, when not to deploy, and whatnot. It is pretty damn special, that's for sure. It's probably one of the greatest safety inventions that we've had in racing in the last 20 years, if not more than that.
Yeah. In Ludi's crash, like, you see him go down right on his back, and, like, if the airbag wasn't on, like, he'd be, like, super messed up. But because, you know, obviously the airbag's deployed, like, you know, it's still going to hurt, but it's, again, the amount of less collarbone breaks that we have nowadays, obviously, you know, a lot of that's due to traction control and limited high sides, but it's still remarkable.
Back to the chaos that is the race. As we had all these people now having fallen off, there was talk of there being a possible stoppage of the race. And sure enough, commentator's curse, if you will, the race was red flagged. So the session was stopped, but it had taken us losing Miller, Espargaro down, pole, that is, on that nasty high side. Marquez had gone down. Iannone had gone down. Morbidelli had gone down. Then Vinales had his really bad crash, which if you watch that one in slow-mo, you can see where he definitely smacks the back of his head on the pavement quite significantly.
You know what I thought interesting about that Vinales crash too is he hits his head and the face shield comes up, and he has enough presence of mind to like reach to his face and close the face shield before he hits the gravel trap. I think that was pretty cool. Again, all courtesy of the slow-mo replay.
That, again, it shows you these guys' mental capacity for what they do. You know, like they say, the great always can race the race using only 80% of their mind, and the other 20% is there to calculate what everybody else is doing and think strategy. So again, just shows you they're just on a different playing field of where they are as far as their concentration, their focus, and their awareness. So again, all courtesy of the slow-mo. So we had the red flag. They went back to lap four. It was a 14 lap race at that point. And so they had Rins declared the winner of the first segment because we hadn't reached three quarter distance. So the race couldn't be considered a full race. So we were going to be in a stopped situation, and we were going to have to see if the rain was going to let up enough for us to actually recontinue. So the way it stood was they would line back up with Rins technically on pole, Dovizioso next to him, Rossi occupying the front row, Pedrosa, who we've not talked about, who again had a very good qualifying session, worked his way through the field, again helped significantly by people who have gone down, crashed, and gone out, but hey, to finish first you must finish. And then Zarco after Pedrosa, Nakagami, Bautista, Paul Asperger would be starting on 8th, and then Redding 9th, Hoffi Siren would be 10th, Lorenzo, Brattle, Pirro, Abraham, Torres, and Smith. So that's who we had left, because that was all the people we had running were 16 motorcycles at this point. And I guess I didn't really count for exactly how long the break was. It might have been 90 minutes maybe. What was it, Derek?
I think it was less than that. I think it was like 40 minutes.
Okay. I kind of lost track in there somewhere because I started to get angsty and was doing other things here and there So I kind of lost track of the time as to where it was. But they did grid up based off of the results of the first segment. And thank goodness we don't have aggregate time anymore. Thank goodness it's just a straight-up race. But we restarted again, and Dovizioso was second behind Rins. Rins was now on a medium front rein. He did not have a soft rein. Now, did you see or have it written anywhere as to why he had the medium front? Because it was speculated that he had used up his allotment of softs, and that was why he was slowing at the in the end of the first segment. Do you know any more about that?
I think in the press conference he says that he had a limited allocation of the tires, and he used the tires he used for warm-up.
Okay.
For gotcha. That second half of the race. So I'm pretty sure that's why, if I'm not misunderstanding the allocation. But I think they do get asked which ones they used and why in the post-race presser.
Okay, I didn't get a chance to watch the post-race presser, so that explains that part of it. That solves that mystery. So Spargaro had charged up from his eighth starting spot to now fourth, but Dovi had gotten past Rins. He sort of used the Ducati power to go past Rins on the front straightaway, and then Dovizioso seemed to be in control in this race at this point. And basically, Dovi just rode out the segment and wound up bringing it home for the win. And then there was still one last bit of chaos left to go. Rossi and Rins were having a good little battle back and forth. And Rossi, at one point, I think Rossi had gotten past Rins and was second. And realizing that Dovizioso was definitely getting away, he had to push to catch him. And then Rossi went down from a second. So he lost the rear. He went down. And so that put Paul Asperger and the KTM in a podium position. And again, as a checkered flag fell, Dovizioso won. Rins finished second. So that was three or four podiums for Rins this year.
I think it was four.
I think it's four as well. So again, you being the Delphic Oracle that you are and playing team manager to the greatest extent, saying Rins is the guy you need to keep and not Ennoni, like I said, you're never going to let me live that down, nor I let myself. But, I mean, Rins definitely showing that he deserves the ride because he has ridden impeccably this year, especially sort of at the second half of the year. Asperger on KTM, I mean, what a day for KTM, because you had Anshu winning the race on a KTM in the IO team. The IO team then winning the team's championship for KTM in Moto2. And then you had KTM's first ever podium on a MotoGP bike. So there's your trivia answer that you will have to be years from now have to remember, because Martin Raines will not be with us when people ask who was the first person to get on a podium on a KTM MotoGP bike. It will be Paul Espargaro. His name is now forever etched in the history of KTM lore, and which is really something cool to see. So a great weekend for KTM. I thought Pit Barra was just the interview with Pit Barra right afterwards was colorful man. Language, but he does. Who cares? He was so stoked to have his team do what they did.
Yeah, man. KTM was, they were dropping F bombs all over the place. It was great. It was just pure emotion. It was fantastic.
That's why we watch sport, right? I mean, that's what you're looking for, is you want that unfiltered emotion. I know I hate, in car racing, I hate when the guys get up there and all it is the first things out of their mouth, I just got to thank, and they rattle off like 15 different sponsors of their car. Yeah. And that just is, it's annoying to me. I like motorcycle racers much more in that respect, where I don't think they really care about the sponsorship. It's just about them. And you can tell they're on that adrenaline high. I mean, Paul was on the adrenaline high. I mean, his brother was there to celebrate with him. I thought that was absolutely fantastic. It was great. And you remember Paul had that really bad crash where he had to sit out for a few weeks and had to heal up. And he had the compression in his spinal cord or something to that effect that was causing him problems. I can't remember
exactly what it was.
I know it was something with his back.
Rough outing from testing, right? Like in testing, yeah. He had to set out most of testing. Like it's just been a rough year in general. And KTM really wasn't having the results they wanted in the first half of the year. And yeah, so I especially Paul, you know, they're keeping Paul, so he can still celebrate that with the team. And you know, they I don't know. I was so stoked to see that. And the repercussions of what that can mean for the team, the confidence that the team can build from that. Zarco coming onto the bike. Pedrosa testing the bike. You have Oliveira learning on the bike. You have Siren doing his thing on the bike. Like, I mean, they're going to have four full factory bikes on the grid. So just the input of the riders, I'm super stoked that they were able to cap off this year going into the Hive next year with that. It's a shame we had to see that because Rossi went down. But I do have to say, I don't know which I would be more stoked about, though, to see Danny on the podium or that Pole got on the podium. Because I got to say, I really wanted to see Danny on the third place, you know? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. He came in fourth. Still solid result for the year he's had, in all honesty. But, I don't know which one. I don't know. I'd probably want to see Danny on the box a little bit more, I guess. But I was still stoked for Pole. That was awesome.
If you asked me, I'd say Asperger and the KTM on the podium or Pedrosa being on the podium, only because I'm a KTM fan and I have a couple KTMs, so I like that idea.
But Jim, they're both orange, you know?
Like, yes, that is true. That is true. They are both they both are orange and navy. So yeah, you got me there. Either way, but I just think for me, it was more about the fact that KTM finally succeeded at something, because they had been knocking on the door, and you know, finding a second is easy. Finding the final tenths of a second is extremely difficult. And granted, they were, you know, rain is the great equalizer, and they were able to capitalize on a situation that was given to them. And yeah, they might have been gifted it, but the team has been working very hard for 2 years to try to get near the front, and they've taken a lot of steps in their development, and they're thinking about how they want to make that bike better, and you can see that it's showing off. So I thought it was just reward for a team that's worked very hard for 2 years.
For sure. And I think it's huge too, because like, if you look at Aprilia, like, I mean, I'm not sure what their best result is. I think it maybe is a sixth place.
I think so.
But the KTM was strong all weekend, even in qualifying. Like, they had good pace in the dry, and
mm-hmm.
visibly, like, even before Pole crashed out, like, he was battling with Mark, like, truly battling. So obviously they had that bike set up well, even if it wasn't in the rain. But yeah, all the credit to them, and hopefully we can see the steps forward next year that we were expecting to see this year. But obviously they've taken a step to get on the podium. So I was probably most pumped over the whole weekend for Pole's podium, but a really exciting, from a spectator point of view, race to be the last race of the season. I was happy that I woke up early to watch this one live. So yeah, no complaints from me.
Man, it could have been a lousy weekend because all the championships were decided, and Valencia is not known for producing the most exciting of racing. Although you have to go back to what Stoner versus tip of my tongue, yeah. Oh gosh,
Lorenzo Pedrosa, Rossi.
No, the American Spies. Sorry, I just blanked out. They had
Corbin Spies. You know,
yeah, he, you know, missed out on that win there, which was exciting.
I forgot about that.
Just a lot of people try to forget about that one.
Yeah,
probably Ben too. But you know, I mean, there's been some races.
He got his win.
He did. But I mean, there has been a few races at Valencia that have been exciting. 2006, Rossi falls, Nikki gets the title. You had
Bayless wins.
Bayless's win on the as he wild carded on the Ducati, which was pretty wild. Because this is the first win for Ducati at that track since Bayless did that, if I'm not mistaken.
No, I think it's since Stoner.
Stoner. Okay, Stoner won there? Okay, all right. Missed that one somewhere in the commentating. So there hasn't, you know, there's maybe the 2006 race is kind of interesting because Nikki wins the title. I mean, Rossi falls off. You know, the real close race finish between Spies and Stoner. Another example of a race that can be a good race. And then this race, which was different just because it was raining the whole time and we had a rain race and you had sort of the chaos of everybody falling. But yeah, it was definitely worth getting up and watching it in the morning. That's for sure.
Do you have anything left to add about the race weekend itself?
No, not really. I think we'll have to get together and do a review of the season kind of a thing, and kind of go through the highs, the lows, and everything of the season, which would be interesting because it was a very interesting season, that's for sure. And then, you know, we have testing to look forward to, starting tomorrow?
Yep, or starting tomorrow. I think they're doing from like 10 to 5, I think.
Yep.
So we got 2 days of testing, and then there's more testing at Jerez the following week. Then you have the Moto 2 testing. Then you have the World Superbike MotoGP test at Jerez with everyone on track at the same time.
Oh, they're not doing that one this year.
No, I thought they were.
Mm-mm. That's gone.
Yeah, I always like that. People get pissy why are you spending millions of dollars on the bikes and it's going faster than you? And, mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's a shame. Yeah. But anyway, maybe we'll try to have a bit of a recap after all those tests happen. I'll definitely be watching the testing tomorrow. And the following day, you get to see everyone in their new colors and the black bikes. Looking forward to it.
The one thing I'm wondering about is Marquez said he wasn't going to get his shoulder fixed until after the Jerez test. I'm wondering if he changes his mind.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see how bad it is tomorrow. I think, not to get too far into it, again, for our testing show, but I think Honda is kind of screwed. You know, you got Mark that's injured. He's going to have surgery. Jorge's obviously injured. They don't have Danny.
They don't have Crutchlow.
They don't have Crutchlow. They really just have Brottle, you know,
mm-hmm.
Who's going to be testing at full fitness. And obviously Mark can test components, you know, the next couple days, but he's not going to be able to do as many laps as he would. And Jorge's just going to kind of trot around on the bike and kind of give it a look, but obviously, he can't really push either, so that's going to be interesting. And obviously, Sepang is where the real developments come, and we'll see how fit both of them are by then. But it's going to be very interesting.
I agree.
All right. Well, I guess with that, again, if we don't have anything further to add, that's going to be it from us today. You can find me on social media at Moto Derek C, Twitter, Instagram, all the social medias. Jim, where can the folks find you?
At Moto RGV on Instagram and Twitter. And if you want to, you guys can leave us feedback for the show. Just email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. You got any questions, comments, things that you want to see, things that you don't want to see, let us know. We always use that to try to make the show better. And the way to do that is to contact us by sending us an email.
Things that you want to hear over the winter break, so we don't leave you guys completely in the dark while the racing is not happening over these cold, cold months.
Yeah, we could have the thing where everybody emails us and says, which tracks would you like to see ran backwards?
Yeah, stuff like that. Or stuff like... I actually really liked last year's the racing memories. We'll brainstorm something like that. So
we'll brainstorm something.
Yeah, we'll
watch have some Twitter
feedback. It'll be good. All right, guys. Until next time, we'll see you out there.